Is polling an art or a science? Welcome back to The Connector, where we bring together innovative, groundbreaking, and collaborative research inside the UT Austin political science universe. I'm your host, Stuart Tendler. This episode is the second conversation we are having about polling, its accuracies and inaccuracies, uses and misuses. It has become popular perception that the science behind polling is flawed. But our guests, Robert Luskin, Darren Shaw, and Chris Valesian, have a different take on things. It is actually the art of the polling, not the science, which poses the biggest challenge. How should questions be worded? In what order should questions be asked? It turns out that the answers to questions such as these can create variation in polling results. We then move on to a discussion of elections, with specific comments about the 2016 election cycle. Recorded in March, in the run-up to Super Tuesday, we explore what the polls might have been telling us about November 2016. At the time, polls were suggesting that the strongest candidates for each party, come November, would have been Bernie Sanders and Marco Rubio. We know now that contest will never happen. However, because it was so early in the campaign season, we also know that the polls were revealing relatively little about eventual election outcomes. There is a timeline to presidential elections. Our guest, Chris Valesian, wrote a book about it. And as the election gets closer, the polls tell us more. Darren and Chris close the episode with some of their thoughts on the question, pointing out, for example, that when an election is a dead heat, a small swing could be the difference between winning and losing.
What is the biggest problem facing polling? And as we were thinking about this, we've focused on technical issues. This, we're kind of responding to the Trump quote about the science behind polling. If I were asked, I would actually go off the board in responding to what I think is the biggest problem with polling. I would actually suggest that it's unmeasurable as opposed to measurable error. In other words, response options, question wording, you know, these sorts of things that can bias and influence results. I think we spend actually a lot of time, and these sort of people who kibitz from the sidelines on polls talk a lot about sample sizes and sample frames and non-response issues and things like all of which are issues. But I think simple things, you know, if you're talking about the science versus the art, I think there's more error introduced by the art of polling in many ways than the science of it. And I don't want to push this argument too far, but, you know, all of us teach classes in which we will put questions side by side that purport to measure the same thing and produce extremely different results because of the way the question's crafted or the response options. And I think this is underrated and under-discussed and, you know, creates problems. The news media don't like to talk about these things because there's a sense that if you discuss these things, you undermine the results. And of course, they paid a lot of money and want to talk about these things, and they don't really want to raise these questions. But that's, I think, a more intelligent discussion of polling would probably focus a lot on these things because they do matter.
Would you say that's equally a problem for candidate preference, which seems a more straightforward thing to ask about as compared to opinions?
You know, not as much. But think about the complexities of a candidate question. Where do I put the ballot in the context of a standard poll? Do I put it after the presidential approval measure or before? After I talk about party immigration ID or party ID or afterwards? Do I have the vice presidential candidate listed as a response option, which is what you have in the ballot? You know, do I replicate the ballot entirely? In which case, now I've got a state-by-state problem because in some states, Daffy Duck can get on the ballot. In other states, it's only the top two candidates. You know, do I push? People who say they're undecided initially, do I say, well, if you had to say, which way would you say you lean? These are all questions, even in a, I agree with Bob's point, even a straightforward question where I think we're going to get, if Chris and Bob and I do a poll independently, I think we're going to get pretty similar results. But you think about this multitude of decisions that you make, all of them potentially could influence the results that you get.
Well, there's an interesting study done by one of our former graduate students, partly by him. It was actually done before he came here. This is Mathieu Tourjon, and it was co-written with Patrick Fournier. And they did an experiment within the questionnaire of the Canadian National Election Study some years back. And what they varied from respondent to respondent randomly was the placement of the vote choice item. And they found that if you ask it at the beginning, it's, you know, not nearly as predictable as it becomes when you ask them at the end. And that's because the process of being interviewed, of answering questions, getting tidbits of information that they pick up incidentally from the questions, it both informs them to agree and still more so stimulates them to think about the choice. And so it's a slightly better informed, slightly better reasoned choice by the end.
I think one of the things that we haven't covered, I'm a little surprised, more than a little surprised actually, we haven't, is what's going on in 2016, what the polls now are telling us about what's happening in the course of the primary season, but also what the polls now are telling us about the matchups, these hypothetical matchups or trial heats that we survey organizations regularly ask, tell us about what's going to happen in November, assuming we get the right candidates in these trial heat matchups. That's interesting, I think.
It is. The thing that strikes me about just immediately after Chris's observation is the difference between Bernie Sanders as a Democratic candidate versus Hillary Clinton, where Sanders
sure.
polls terrifically against potential Republican nominees as opposed to Hillary Clinton. And then the variance in Trump as a Republican nominee, that I've seen him fairly consistently polling least well, but I've seen a few instances in which he's actually polled very well.
But typically least well.
Although I would guess that the greatest variance would probably be associated with Trump moving forward. That is, I could see Trump staying where he is. I could see him gaining 10 points in the ballot. I could see him losing 10 points in the ballot. I wouldn't probably guess that for Cruz or Rubio or Kasich, but
and the Democratic
but Sanders
side,
maybe.
But Sanders, maybe, yeah. I think
likely to gain as much as he's likely to lose.
I think he's more likely to lose.
Yeah. I agree with that.
But
I think that these choices, hypothetical though they currently are for November, the polling results probably are reasonably accurate what we'd see if the election were held today. But there's a lot of time between now and then, a lot of campaigning and counter-campaigning to do. I think in the case of Sanders, the Republicans have given him a free ride so far. That's partly because they think Hillary's going to be the nominee, but it's also partly, I think, because they like Sanders to be the nominee, thinking him a weaker opponent. And at any rate, whatever the motivation, once the campaign for the general election begins, if Sanders is the Democratic nominee, that free ride will be completely over and he'll be hit hard. So my guess is his poll results, not because the poll is inaccurate for preferences as they stand, but those poll results will be significantly off for November.
Let's be a little more explicit then. What are the polls saying right now? Who are the best candidates for each party? Did I hear the polls are saying Sanders is the
Rubio
and Sanders
nationally right now? Sanders polls significantly better than Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. By significantly, I mean in a ballot race where Clinton is roughly even, say with Ted Cruz, Sanders will be up 9 points.
The difference
really isn't
as wide on the other pairwise, but still, it's pretty big, four points.
And what we've seen now is that Rubio tends to poll strongest amongst the four remaining Republican candidates. At this juncture, you're talking about Trump, Kasich, Cruz, and Rubio. Kasich, I think, largely because people don't really know who he is.
Right.
And so you get a wide number of undecideds. And the undecideds come disproportionately from Republicans or independents who don't know who he is, whereas the Democrats know who their candidates are. So the obvious conclusion would be that Kasich probably has the most ground to pick up. Most Republicans know who Cruz is and are sort of on board. I think the ballot that's most kind of instructive and informed would be a Hillary versus Cruz matchup, because Republicans basically know who Cruz is and Democrats know who Hillary is and they sort of sort themselves accordingly. Rubio and Kasich are a little more wild cards, and Trump is just extremely difficult to figure right now. Some Republicans aren't on board with him, and so he loses support compared to a generic Republican candidate. He maybe gains back a slight amount because there's some independents or Democrats who may have already crossed over, but it's very difficult, as Chris and Bob were suggesting, to figure out what ultimately a Trump-Clinton or Trump-Sanders matchup looks like. A Trump-Sanders matchup will be a delight from us from a process and research point of view, may not be what the Republican wants, but...
But we know that polls at this point in the election year tell us relatively little about what's going to happen on election day, right? So, I mean, at the beginning of the election year, based on history, the relationship between the polls and the vote is literally zero. So we really can't tell whether one candidate is going to win or another, regardless of what the polls tell us. But by this point in time in the cycle, we're really starting to ramp up. We go from like zero to 50 in the first 60 to 90 days, which is what we're right in the middle of. So we're part of the way there, but we're probably about a third of the way there, maybe a quarter of the way there. It could be more or less depending on the candidates, right? We don't know who they're going to be for sure.
I do think that there's, you know, when people have the observation, well, there's nothing to be, and this is not what Chris is saying, but when people will say, like, well, there's nothing to learn from the polls, well, that's somewhat nonsensical. I mean, what you do know is in an open election, and this is an open race with the incumbent, you know, leaving, Hillary Clinton is a fairly well-known commodity. You know, there's not going to be a lot of change. I mean, she may be able to reinvent herself a little bit at a convention. You never know. But she's such an established product that by the standards of an open election, and these would be, you know, 1988, 2000, and again in 2008, we don't have many cases really in recent history. You know, she's a pretty well-known commodity. And I think it'll be hard for her to move the dial very much on that. You know, she's fairly well-known. On the Republican side, it's more kind of typical of an open race. And I'm definitely with Chris on that. Who knows whether these Republican candidates, should they, you know, grab the nomination, be able to consolidate the base, expand the base, or, you know, completely underperform.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that for the Republicans, probably the safest choice is not one they're likely to make is Kasich. I don't think he'd do badly. The others there's much more uncertainty about, I think, and they have greater strengths and weaknesses. Of course, Mitt Romney thinks the safest choice would be Mitt Romney.
Chris, just back to your point. You're saying right now the polls are telling us relatively little about how the election is going to turn out. But at some point, they tell us a lot is kind of what you've discovered, correct?
Right.
And that at some point, there's a time to it, right? There's a timeline. Yeah.
I believe it's a timeline, right, Chris? Isn't that the timeline right, of, say, presidential elections?
Presidential elections, yes.
That would be a good book. Is there a month? I mean, are we talking like July or something like that?
Well, if the beginning of the year it's zero, by, say April, early April, mid-April, we're about 50% of the story. So it's a pretty linear, pretty... We kind of get into a quiet season, typically when we've sorted out the candidates. I mean, maybe this year will be a little different, I think, as at least on one side, maybe on both sides, in which case things may drag on as we're sorting out who we're matching up. By the end of March, we usually know who the candidates are. And this year, we probably will know. It looks like we'll know one. It'll be less clear we'll know the other, which makes it harder for people to actually be, you know, and as Bob has said, you know, the degree to which one's is focused on the decision that really matters, right, at the end is going to affect the seriousness, the reliability of their responses. And so we don't know really what, you know, they're going to mean something maybe a little bit less when the candidates are unclear than when they are clear. Usually we know by the end of March, and then things kind of quiet down, and then they wrap back up in the summer with the conventions. And people, you know, people are picking their vice presidential candidates, the conventions actually occur. People are refocused on politics, and you know they may flirt early on, right? Oh yeah, I'm a Republican, and maybe I'll consider voting for that Democratic candidate, until one finds out that they really are a Democrat, and they're saying Democratic kinds of things, and that's what conventions are good for.
I mean, my last question would be that sort of a campaign becomes a campaign story less than a polling story, right? Because now we're talking about That's sort of the other side, right? How much campaigns can move public opinion, right? So you're saying at some point the polls are giving an accurate demonstration of what opinion really is and how it's going to be expressed at the polls because the campaigns are no longer going to move that. Is that correct or not?
Right. Well, I think the way Darren and I would characterize it is it's not like we have a static world, right? That the polls are becoming increasingly informative about, right, is a dynamic world. And it's not dynamic necessarily in the sense that people are changing their positions, right? But they could be. But so in that sense, they may be static. They may be the same candidates with the same positions. But that's not just what, you know, campaigns inform us engage us, ask us to pay attention, and think seriously about what we're doing, and we do. And so as a result, yes, polls become more informative. And so campaigns are doing that, are having that kind of effect. But maybe not in the same way I think that other people might think of campaigns, and in a way that is sort of distortion and gaffes and, errors, which is a way that I think some people characterize campaign effects.
People think of the phrase we use in political science sometimes is enlightened preferences, which is not quite what it sounds like, but is a useful phrase, I think. And that is that we assume that people are going to move in some sense in a predictable way. That Republicans are going to figure out who their nominee is, and Democrats will figure out who their nominee is. That people will get a sense of the economy and whether the in party has done a good job of managing the economy, and that prior to people focusing on the election in this period from say January to March that Chris was talking about, not knowing who the candidates are and not really cluing into politics, that there's a lot of noisiness to these polls, and so they're not terribly predictive. But once people focus in, begin to sort themselves, once, they kind of move in the places that we sort of expect them to, given conditions, then the polls become very accurate. And you can get, within the sort of smallish band, of 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 points, you can see these movements in the polls that occur in response to the events of the campaign, whether it's a convention or some sort of change in the dynamic, a candidate picks up on a particular issue theme, or there's a gaffe. And there's a question about how much we care about those things. Are these sorts of effects that the polls oftentimes pick up on short-lived, or, do they result in kind of a sea change in which, a 2 or 3 point difference becomes the new baseline against which we judge the expectation of the election? And, so from the outside, people will look at what the conversation is in political science and say that, you guys are talking about these really small changes and aren't they within margin of error, as we were talking about earlier? And it's like,
yes.
But if they're consistent, and if you're talking about a country that's essentially split down the middle when it comes to national elections, they become extremely consequential. And there are elections where people don't get to the places we think they're going to be getting to, and 2000 is the famous example where all the external conditions suggested that Al Gore should, capitalize on Bill Clinton's popularity and the relatively robust economy, although there's some dispute about that at the end, but, and be a very strong candidate to carry on the Democratic control of the White House. And yet he ended up in a tie, basically, with George W. Bush. And so these are tendencies and things that we expect to happen, and more often than not happen, but as we've seen from the last 6 months, you'll go out of business predicting politics, and, I feel like a weatherman here, right? We're predicting the weather, and we said it was going to be sunny, and it's rained, and now people are questioning our ability, our knowledge of any kind of political phenomena, and, while on the one hand I think, that's kind of unfair. On the other hand, we probably shouldn't have been making those predictions in the first place.
It's kind of like predicting the weather in San Diego.
Yes, exactly. It's like predicting the weather in, Tulsa. But we set ourselves up for it. We can't resist making these predictions sometimes, and that means you're going to be wrong. And politics is a social science, and we've seen so much. There's so much to be humble about from our perspective in the last 6 months. But we do think we have some core understandings, and we're moving forward with those.
That's it for the Connector's first take on polling. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and if the candidates have not revved you up, perhaps we have you feeling that much more excited to be in the midst of a presidential election year. And remember, at the University of Texas at Austin, we have our own polling outfit. Just search online for the Texas Politics Project, and I promise you'll find it. As always, to send feedback, you can find me at gov.utexas.edu.